Hi, podcast listeners. Alice here with a quick announcement about this episode of The Spoiler Guys. Alas, it seems Gremlins, or potentially Gollum, crawled into Mark's recording app and deleted the file. So, as you'll hear, I've done my best to scavenge some audio, but we do apologise in advance for the quality, and I promise we didn't throw Mark into Gollum's cave for being disappointed by The Hobbit. So now, on with the show.
Far over the misty mountains rise, leave us standing upon the height. What was before, we see once more, is our kingdom a distant light.
Hello, and welcome to another Spoiler Guys podcast, where we bring you the film review that's only safe to listen to after the credits roll. I'm Alice Tynan, and my spoiler guys are SMH Online Entertainment Editor Giles Hardy. Greetings.
Hello, and greetings to you, Alice.
Hello. And that movie guy, Mark Fennell.
My precious has been ruined.
Yes, that's right. Today we are venturing back to Middle Earth with the first installment of Peter Jackson's new trilogy, The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey. Now, considering we all know the story by osmosis, if not required school reading, I don't think there are any story spoilers to have, but there are certainly technological aspects to review. But first, an expectation.
Well, technically, there is a spoiler story to be had, which is how far into the story do they get?
Oh, yes, okay, but first.
Approximately, they finally leave the dinner table, but my God, it takes some time.
We're getting ahead of ourselves.
We certainly are.
Unlike the film.
Certainly, yeah, oh. Right? Ouch. Okay, right, let's start off, as we always do, with an expectations check. Giles, were your expectations hobbit-sized, dwarf-sized, or orc-sized going in?
I think my problem, and I suspect many audiences' problem, is that my expectations were smorg-sized. and that's...
Man, this got dirty real fast.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. Did we want to approach these like Olympic athletes? Though that might be good if it involves taking something.
As opposed to really
it was a film of three halves. Unfortunately, it probably is a film of three halves. My expectations were too high, I have no doubt. If I had the expectations I had and I saw only the third hour, I think I'd be a lot happier.
Bless. And you, Mark, did you have your hairy hobbit feet ready to venture back to the Shire?
I was so keen to go back to Middle-earth. I've been re-watching the extended... I've never seen the extended versions of Lord of the Rings, so I kind of went back and I was just like, oh my God, I'm so excited to go back to Middle-earth. And that movie, The Hobbit...
The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey...
First installment.
Could not have underwhelmed me more. I am... When I first watched it, I was like, and then I got to the end, I was like... And every minute since I've seen the film, it has diminished in my expectation. And it's been really sad. I'll be honest with you, I'm really sad.
You're grieving right now.
Well, Mark, while you sit on the fence, Alice, what did you think?
So my expectations were Middle-earth size. If you were Smaug sized, I was Middle-earth sized. I was so excited. And considering I went on the junket and I was literally in the middle of Middle-earth, as they called Wellington, probably. So yeah, I was there and it was hard not to get swept up in the excitement of the junket. Everyone was just on pins. Everyone was jumping out of their skin. And so as I got to go to Park Road Post and see it, granted, the screening had a sound issue for the first 20 minutes and it almost broke my heart. And because I think it was because of that sound issue, I went, you know what? First act, going to have to take a mulligan. Going to need a mulligan on the first act because it was ruined by the sound issue.
But that's not fair because you only missed 20 minutes of 2 hours of first act.
That's true. So I'm going to say...
Are you telling me the full impact of the 20-minute montage where dwarves rock up to Bilbo's house? You didn't get the full impact?
I didn't.
I'm not sure that we get to that point in the first 20 minutes. I think we actually just have... Have you met Frodo? Because here's that bit where we explain this story is related to the Lord of the Rings, just in case you hadn't picked up on that from the Air New Zealand ad that was on beforehand.
Yeah. The Air New Zealand ad is actually the best thing about the entire screen.
The Air New Zealand ad is brilliant. We'll have to share it around if people haven't seen it. So yeah, okay, I went in with huge expectations and I came out going, I need to see that again. Because of the sound issue and because of the 48 frames per second. But what I loved, I did genuinely love being back in that world. So I think I'm going to be on the yay, go the Hobbit. Mark can be, boo, you've broken my heart. Giles can be...
Hi, I'm looking forward to the film starting.
Right.
So I was going to say, Giles, does it hurt?
The fed
so far up your
back. No, I in fact safely cleared the fence because I was on your side of the fence for 2 hours and then just jumped over to the other side of the fence for Alan.
So you're right. The last hour certainly brings it to life a lot more. And the last hour saves a bit, but look, I'm sure we'll get into this more detail, but just stating it outright, it is way too padded out. It does not need to be three films. There is not enough on the page. And there's nothing at stake. You know, the first movie, we're talking about a guy who wants to cover the lands of Middle-earth and darkness. That shit sounds great. Whereas in this one, it's like a bunch of dwarves couldn't find a home for themselves. Like, seriously, guys, get a real estate agent.
I think we discussed recently the point of narration and the fact that we find don't say frustrating. This has a different problem in that they all sit down and explain the entire plot and then they go, well, I suppose we should start doing it now. And between the fact that the dwarves all sit down and have a long exposition, and then, just in case you missed the Lord of the Rings, Gandalf and a couple of other wizards and elves sit down and they discuss how the fact this is, in case you were wondering, going to cause and bring about the Lord of the Rings. There's a lot of people sitting around going, this film's important, and it's important that you understand how important it is. By the way, it'll have a plot sometime.
Okay, I'm going to say, you were talking about stakes, Mark. I think that this is crucial for expectations of people going into this film. You need to realise this is a kid's story. It's a 300-page kid's story about dwarves who don't have a home and a hobbit who helps them get one.
Then why wasn't it treated as such?
And this is a big question, and I do think it might be a case of hubris, but I do think that if you go in with expectations thinking this is going to be Lord of the Rings, you'll be horribly disappointed. If you go in thinking this is a really sweet kid's story about a really, I mean, Bilbo, Martin Freeman is fantastic as Bilbo, and if you go in thinking this is going to be a sweet children's story told incredibly well with amazing digital effects, we can get onto that later, then I think you'll have a great time.
Yeah, no, there's no question that Martin Freeman is brilliant.
Absolutely.
He's quite fantastic, and he's got that fantastic sense of being a stranger lost in a strange world, which now that I say that, that doesn't make any sense, but that's not the point.
That's a good album title, though.
Yeah, Talking Heads could release it. You know, in that sense, it was really good. But even if you're thinking about it as a kid's film, though, as a kid's film, kids would be so bored out of their mind.
Yep.
Because there's so little that... I come back to the 20-minute montage where dwarves knock on doors. Like, even in that context, there's not enough going on. And look, admittedly, you are right that the last hour is really, really very fun. But it doesn't make up for how bored I was for the first 2 hours of the film. I also find the awkwardly trying to shoehorn Lord of the Rings relevance into it a little bit trying. And a lot of that is actually from the book. I know I'm not totally nixing it for that, but there are a lot of scenes, like some kind of visual references that they reference from the other movies, like when the eagle comes by and picks him up. And I understand that that's actually a part of the Hobbit narrative, but you kind of watch it and go, and it does that similar thing. It's actually a similar sensation I had to The Bourne Legacy, where every time you show me a picture of Matt Damon, I'm simply reminded that he's not in this film. And I understand...
And the film's the poorer for it.
And the film's the poorer for it. And look, I kind of like The Bourne Legacy, but that's the issue here is that every time you do those references, there's a fine line between enhancing The Lord of the Rings, you know, like as good kind of prequels can do. They can actually reframe how you view the original product. And then there's just every time you see something that reminds you of that movie, it's like, right, you're not that.
Yeah, I think that it's funny, Alice, how you're saying you walked out thinking, I really want to see that again. I suspect very few people will have that response. Because it is, the more I think about it, the more it's the film I'm going to go, I've seen that now, and I am looking forward to the second film. It's not that I despise this. I think it was disappointing because expectations were so high. But I think there's no part of me, other than a technical curiosity, which I suspect we'll get to soon, I have no real desire to see this film again, because the first of us, the film I've just suddenly realised it compares to me is Titanic, because it's the first 2 hours build up to the last hour, which is the one that everyone wants to see. And
but are you going to sit through those first 2 hours to get to the last one again?
And it's a big ask to find yourself really wanting to do that. And the other film that I found myself thinking about was there's been a lot of debate online lately about what is the appropriate order in which to watch the Star Wars films. And which would you, if you were to you know, your child, I have a 2-year-old, at some point I want to introduce him to the Star Wars universe, at some point I want to introduce him to Middle-earth. He's going to be older when he meets Middle-earth, I can tell you that, because it's a hell of a lot more violent. But what film do you start with?
And Horror I don't shit, not The Phantom Menace.
For Whoa. The Hobbit, no. but no, I mean, I think I don't know that I would introduce the Middle Earth films with The Hobbit.
Okay.
It's interesting because I hate to make this comparison, but The Hobbit is kind of not as bad. It is The Phantom Menace.
No,
that's been a really popular comparison, and I don't think it's justified.
Let me clarify, not just because it's worse, and it is, but not just because it's worse, but also because it is pitching younger. It is pitching towards kids, and George Lucas always said that's what his goal was with the original trilogy, and I think in that sense it's an accurate comparison. I also think that it's much like Phantom Menace, it retroactively makes the whole franchise weaker. However, let me be very, very clear, I do not think it is in any way, quite as bad as the Phantom Menace. But I think functionally, in terms of the role it plays within the broader franchise, I think it is. And for all my complaints, I am very excited to see Hobbits 2 and 3, because clearly something has to happen.
Well, the dragon finally woke up at the third hour, so, you know, that could be interesting.
The blink was the most exciting part of the movie.
Spoiler alert, Smaug blinks at the end. Look, I have now seen the film twice.
How to undersell a film.
Yeah, I've now seen it twice, and I agree the first act is just awful, although what I thought they were going for was the children's kind of, hey, here are some action figures that your kids are going to want to buy because aren't the dwarves all really hokey? I don't think it works. I thought the first act dragged.
You can tell them apart. That was the other thing.
Yeah, I mean, 13 dwarves, so hard to individuate. It was a tough road to hoe.
Yes, it was clear. Like, he came out, but everybody else.
No, I'm sorry, I have no problem with that. But I think there's no problem with that aspect of it. And I think that almost was the only benefit out of having 2 hours of slowly meeting all these dwarves.
Yeah, you did need to individuate them. And I could see, this is where I know that I had a problem with the film, because I was sitting there going, I understand why you did this, but. And I think that that's the problem.
The fact I just had to explain it to myself, and the fact that I had time to do so is not a good sign.
Exactly. Yeah. But once we get on the road, I love when Bilbo goes, hold up, we have to go back, I forgot my handkerchief. Like, there is a lot of humour in the film, and once they finally get on the road, it does kind of get into that epic scope. But the big thing that I want to talk about is obviously the 48 frames per second. I've now seen it twice in 48.
I was fascinated that you chose to watch it the second time in 48 frames per second.
Yeah, I was curious about that decision too.
Because the first 20 minutes were ruined with the sound issue. So I wanted to know whether or not my issue with 48 was because I had an issue with the sound. So I wanted, because that's a crucial, those first 20 minutes are a crucial time to get used to that. And because I'd been so alienated by, oh my gosh, Howard Shore's score's got this all the way across it, I wanted to see it again.
I think it's great that we've got the capacity to talk about this from the we've seen the film version, because the discussion you can't have in any review is the scene that sets up the problems best for 48 frames per second of me is the Gollum scenes. Because when Bilbo puts the ring on and we get the stylized treatment of the footage, pretty much the Instagram footage, it looks about 1,000% better. Like, it suddenly felt like it was treated footage, like it was
magical.
It felt cinematic.
Yeah.
Like, it, until that point, it had felt like cutscenes from a video game, and that meant that you had the same problem that you get where motion feels really weird. And, like, it always feels like you've got the shaker compensator on that is on bad home video cameras. Like, the movement suddenly just, your brain, something deep in your subconscious is going, this isn't right!
Which is ironic, because the whole thing of 48 is supposed to make it clearer and clearer for the eye.
But I think that meant that they had to compensate for things like shakes. And I'm not sure there isn't actual shaking compensation involved.
Okay, so 48, I am the guy who is so keen to see filmmakers innovate with technology. I'm well behind 3D.
You're the download this show guy. Yeah, you're all about innovation.
Yeah. I'm all about seeing how people innovate. I love seeing people do ambitious things with technology, and I'm sure when we get to doing Life of Pi, we'll discover that. And I love seeing people try new things, but bugger me, 48 frames does not. I'm open to seeing people try it in a new way, but 48 frames for me right now does not work. And I mentioned this when I tweeted about the movie, and I got a lot of responses back from people going, people haven't seen the film. Dude, this is the future. This is, you know, you're just another one of those whingy film critics. I defy you to watch this movie and think it looks like anything other than a bad video game cutscene. And it is just, I'm open to seeing people do it better in the future, because I think things like this are a tool, can be used well, can be used badly, but in this film it looks like the world's most expensive episode of The Bold and Beautiful.
Or the world's most expensive episode of Xena Warrior Princess by way of a video game. Like, it's really weird. Okay, I've got two names to drop. First one, James Cameron on the red carpet of the world premiere was basically saying, you know, props to Peter Jackson for taking the risk of going to 48 on such a huge
film. Finally, someone can get yelled at aside from me.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Like, well done, you took the flak for me. Second one is Christopher McQuarrie, and we were talking to him about Jack Reacher earlier, and he was saying that it's going to take a generation to get used to it. And so
I was a fan.
I know, not so much a fan, but what thinks that you know what you're used to, what you've grown up with, and that it will take a generation to get used to it.
Not that I have, you know, tickets on myself, but I disagree with Chris McQuarrie. What does he know? No, because my one plus, and it took me so long to even realise this, was this film nails 3D better than any film has yet.
How great is the 3D?
It is spectacular 3D. And the tragedy is that all we can talk about is that 48 frames per second ruined so much that I have no idea how much it is part of why the 3D worked, but I thought the 3D was really good.
Because, again, for me, the high point of 3D at this point is still Avatar.
Well, I think the high point of 3D will change in a week's time as well, because I think Life of Pi moves it along again.
I mean, Life of Pi does, and actually, at risk of talking about too many movies at once, I mean, Life of Pi is just so ambitious in the way they use technology, and for whatever faults the film has, and I think we all agree that it definitely has some faults, when it does something ambitious, it totally succeeds in terms of its visuals. Whereas in this film, maybe because I couldn't see the third dimension for the additional 24 frames that I did not need.
The forest for the trees. How are you trying to make that analogy?
The
forest for the 48 trees?
I'll tell you what movie I do think is about to use 3D quite phenomenally, and I saw 9 minutes of it last night, which is Star Trek Into Darkness.
There's your name drop.
Yeah, there's my name drop. Now, I've only seen 9 minutes of it, but one of the things that's striking about it is they've really managed to balance that thing that J.J. Abrams did with the first film.
Which the lens flare?
Yeah, the shaky camera. There's a bit of lens flare action going on, but he also uses 3D in a really fun way. So you've got things poking out the screen at you, which I actually think people should do more with 3D.
Well, to answer your question, what I loved about the 3D with this is I felt like they didn't play a single trick. Like, there was not a moment of brain shear, which is what James Cameron and his team refer to. There was nothing played with in 3D. It was just used to make this expansive universe in which it was set. And I thought it was almost, I suspect, because they were so focused on 48 frames per second, they never thought, oh, maybe we could do something interesting in 3D. And because it was just became part of it, this is, to go back to my point, why I disagree with Chris McQuarrie, because I think in what is effectively 3 or 4 years, we've pretty much now started just taking 3D as a given. I don't think it'll take a generation at all for 48 frames per second if the filmmaking universe picks it up. And that's going to be the big question. It's whether the industry finds a reason to do this, because there's no reason why 48 frames per second is going to require additional cinema tickets. They can't charge you for glasses. They can't use it as a means of preventing piracy. I think it's going to be interesting to see if the industry gets behind it. And otherwise, it's either going to be 5-10 years or never.
So the question is 48 frames going to be what colour and sound were? Or is it going to be scratch and sniff? Because all of those things were gimmicks. All of those things were decried as gimmicks when they were first introduced.
Well, so was 3D. You know, Hitchcock was using it way back when.
Exactly. And
so was Jaws.
Exactly. And so the question is, actually my favourite one is when they first introduced sound to films. There was a whole cabal of German film critics who sat back and went, this is terrible. This will turn all this beautiful visual art form of cinema into something lower than theatre. This is a terrible idea. In actual fact, they were right. It did actually turn cinema largely into theatre. But, you know, again, like any technique, it was used well, it was used badly. And this is what I'm saying, I'm open to the idea of them using this well, but as a first example, it is not encouraging.
Okay, well, let's move on to talking about the CGI, because I had a bit of an issue. Okay, so on my flight back from the world premiere, I rewatched Fellowship of the Rings. Turns out, flight from Auckland to Sydney, perfect 3-hour window to watch Fellowship of the Rings.
As I understand it, they actually circle the plane 3 times so that they could make it work perfectly.
Yeah, so that you can get that finished. You know, Boromir has
flight
to die.
Flight should only be 23 minutes long.
So anyway, I rewatched it and I felt like Fellowship really had such a great sense of place, and you were in Middle-earth, and Middle-earth felt real, whereas here I understand it, it's much more of a fantasy novel, and they go into the Goblin's Den, and we can talk about that because I thought that was great, but I did feel like it was more CGI for less. Like, more is not necessarily more when every single scene, every single setting was CGI'd.
That's a really interesting point, because I think one of the things I was concerned about when I first had this really negative reaction to it was, you know, not all that much happens in Fellowship of the Rings either, and maybe I'm being really unfair. Went back, rewatched Fellowship of the Ring, tons more happen. But actually what struck out at me was the fact that in those first three, particularly the first two, actually, Lord of the Rings movies, they really went out of their way to film things for real, use a lot of practical effects. And I don't know whether it was the combination of 3D and 48 frames, but I could tell everything was computer.
Especially in daytime scenes, right? Oh, they look weirdly stuck on, and they were moving in this sync. The digidoubles were moving in this weird syncopated fashion, and
at the same time, the CGI worked better in the 48 frames per second. I really found it hard at times when they were out on, you know, the plains of New Zealand. You'd suddenly just go, I don't feel like I'm in Middle Earth anymore. I genuinely feel like someone's just walking around New Zealand and not a particularly amazing part of it. Like when
there's the line, like the digital composites. I think there's one particular shot early on with Sauron Oakenshield, and they do a big swoop around him on some bridge, and I was like, I can see where you've etched that.
Mm.
I can see it.
You mean the one of like 50,000 hero shots that Thorin gets? Like, is he not just Braveheart meets 300? Like the entire time is like hero shot.
Oh, so is Thorin meant to be the? I thought he was like a bit of an extra.
Yeah, no, like, he's supposed to be Aragorn. No one's going to take
him. Yeah, that's
Aragorn.
Not going to go well for him.
Every single shot, I could see the etching, and it's just like, this is not a seamless experience. I'm just completely left out of this world.
Except for the Goblin's Den, which I thought, as a CGI world, with Barry Humphreys being brilliant as the Great Goblin, I did feel
beautifully unrecognisable. Like, unless you knew it was Barry Humphreys, you didn't hear it. It wasn't like it was Dame Edna leading the Goblins.
From a comedic standpoint, the movie was quite good. Like, he was required to comic timing.
Yeah, he was fantastic with his swinging goiter. But I did feel, and I wonder if this is saying something. Is this saying something? I did feel
if you're about to do shadow puppets, it won't work in a podcast.
So I did feel like the Goblin's Den felt more like Guillermo del Toro.
It felt more
like Guillermo's touch. I was like, wow, this feels like his aesthetic, all the look of them all. I'm curious to find out, because in that fantasy world, I was like, right, this could be a part of Pan's Labyrinth in a way, whereas that felt real to me, whereas the other sets felt really like sets.
I thought the only other really good set was what was happening beneath that, the stuff with Gollum. I thought that was done really nicely.
Yeah, the Gollum stuff works.
Okay, speaking of CGI, we cannot go past the CGI extravaganza that is Gollum and Andy Serkis in that extraordinary chamber piece. Now, this was the first scene they shot, and they rehearsed it like a chamber piece of theatre, and oh my goodness, in both screenings, I noticed the whole audience just sit up and take notice. Oh my God, that's a great scene.
Yeah, the film totally, utterly comes alive.
And it's refreshing because it's a two-hander. It's just two guys acting incredibly well.
And that's why it's refreshing, because they are actually saying things. They are things that have point and actually advance the story. They are amusing, but not amusing for the sake of distraction because nothing's happening.
Yeah, it's also fascinating because the reason it has stakes has nothing to do with the plot of The Hobbit. It has everything to do with the plot of Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
The thing at stake is the ring. It has nothing to do with whether or not the dwarves find a home. It is all about the ring.
And that's the interesting thing, because I haven't read The Hobbit for a long time. One of the things I remember when I read it was how much you were really conscious of the fact that I think Gollum's going to try and eat Bilbo.
That's scary.
In the film, that was lost because it became much more about the ring, because you knew what the ring was about. I actually thought the scene really worked better. I thought it was an interesting classic case of adaptation. You can change focus, change some things, and it works better. Like, it wasn't that they didn't give credence to the fact that he might eat it, but it didn't become the threat somehow. That scene worked for me, whereas the scene that I was really disappointed by was the scene with the trolls, where we're waiting for the sun to come up, and that was just, like, that's one of the great scenes. Whenever they've done picture books of The Hobbit, that's always one of the scenes kids love, because it's Bilbo being crafty, and thus, in a very kiddie kind of way, outdoing the big bully-like character. Like, it's classic kid story stuff. And in this, it just became drawn out, and all of the party had to be involved, because damned if we're not allowed to have just some moments with only a few characters, and it just didn't work for me, that scene. And that was really frustrating because it is such a big scene in the saga.
Yeah, they were really gormless, those trolls. And I it was one of those moments where, like, I can see where you're going and I can see that you're probably pushing for laughs for kids because it was that really obvious kind of kids' humour. But I just, again, the scene just went for way too long and I'm like, just eat them already. I'm done. Like, yeah.
I couldn't agree more. That was exactly it. You just sat there after all going, I have no idea why you haven't eaten them.
Like, just do it.
But that's the problem, is you inherently have to have created a scenario where you go, it is believable and plausible that Bilbo has been crafty. And the other thing is, A, they drew it out, but somehow still, Bilbo didn't appear to have actually done anything. Like, because it required Gandalf to tell everyone, you do realise who's dragging it out. And I felt like Gandalf was saying to the audience, I realise we didn't really make that clear, so just so you know.
I don't know. I mean, the second, like, I did feel like he was trying to outfox them, and they were such idiots that they were able to be like, what? What do we need sage? What? And I did have a giggle, but it just goes on for way too long.
Speaking of things that went on for way too long, can we talk about the scene with Galadriel, Saruman,
and Gandalf?
And who's the other one?
Hugo Weaving.
Lord Elrond.
Lord Elrond. That scene was really kind of frustrating for me because I was watching it going, this would be a great prelude scene in The Lord of the Rings.
Yep.
Again, it was one of those moments where I'm only engaged in this because of its relevance to The Ring, nothing to do with The Hobbit.
This is what I'm talking about, scenes that were involved in people sitting around and explaining what will happen later. That is not necessary in a film. But it's not even exposition. It really was, this is going to happen later.
Well, I loved it simply for the fact that the piece of face acting between Sir Ian McKellen and Cate Blanchett when they're reading each other's minds, that is worth sitting through that film to see them, like, talking at each other, but not really, and just the look in Gandalf's face when he's like, when she goes, you knew they were leaving, right? And he's like, yeah. So,
and I do love just what I've seen, because I'm having rewatched Lord of the Rings, it's just Cate Blanchett, crazy eye.
Yeah.
And you will have a queen who will rule it. She does that eye like 50 times in her, like, in the various extended bits, and then she does it again in this, and little part of me is like, oh my god, you're crazy.
Crazy eye. Well, there's a spoiler right there.
Indeed. Look, that scene also frustrated me because I felt like Saruman suddenly became less than one dimensional. I mean, he may as well have been sort of rubbing his hands together and going, by the way, I'm going to be evil later. Evil, I tell you.
But in fairness, he was that man.
Yeah, but his backstory is, at this point, he's meant to be, like, these are three intelligent / vaguely awake people. Yeah. The notion is that they shouldn't have been able to see that he was evil. And you felt like a 6-year-old was going to stand up and go,
evil one.
That one's evil!
Yeah.
No, he's not evil, he's evil.
Evil! Yeah, that's the thing. There are 6 E's in the evil that he is.
Well, speaking of wizards, should we spend a little bit of time talking about Radagast and his bird poo?
Yeah, that's the tragedy, God, isn't it? It's like they're embarrassed about it.
Okay, so
he's literally jumping up and down right now.
Well, he's bouncing, technically.
Okay, here's the thing. A character like Radagast is supposed to be like the Jack Sparrow moment in Pirates of the Caribbean. It's supposed to be like Gollum was. It's supposed to be this character who comes in at a certain point during the movie and is played by a brilliant character actor who just injects every single moment with something unique.
It's Falstaff.
Yes.
This is a Shakespearean device. Yeah. It's not, you know, I mean, as Pirates of the Caribbean, literature,
but what I'm saying is, in the context of a movie, it's supposed to be that you cast somebody brilliant to come in and just steal the movie.
Of course.
And he just dies on the ground. No, you're wrong. Sylvester McCoy is the next Doctor Who. And, like, he's sitting there going, really? There is so much, like, you could see functionally its role within.
Do you know why? Not a single person reacted to him turning up. That was the thing that really stood out for me. He was amazing. And this freaking lunatic turned up. 13 dwarves and a hobbit all went, eh, totes saw that coming. I am street cool and I don't react to nothing. And that's ridiculous. Like, he was there so that they could, I mean, they all should have run away or started throwing things at him or possibly, you know, tied him up and taken sharp objects away. But no one did anything.
I'm sorry, I would have a better response to it, but I just heard you say totes and look at my
brain. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that was the thing. I felt like the dwarves were trying to be street cred. It's wrong.
Or the fact that Radagast was out-acted by the little dying hamster thing that was really cute.
That was very cute.
Yeah, I was happy to go along with.
The bunny sled was cool.
Yeah, the bunny sled was cool.
Was very cool.
And, like, wait for me.
And also, I like that we don't have any idea what happened.
Well, the last we saw him,
he was being chased and then.
Well, yeah, he went to see the to and found the necromancer and got the sword from Mordor or whatever. And the necromancer is apparently played by Benedict Cumberbatch, as is Smaug. Yes. Spoiler. Yes.
Yeah, well, that was just another plot point that was picked up. And look, I get it because it's the first part, it's not really going to go anywhere. But even if you watch something like the Fellowship of the Ring, there is a significant amount of satisfaction at the end of that film, even though you had this yearning for more.
Well, you can't complain you didn't get a cliffhanger.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, right? What is the point of dropping them off in the middle of nowhere on top of a cliff?
I must admit,
a cliffhanger?
I was vaguely surprised that the cliffhanger wasn't the end of the film. Like, that was the thing. It's like, ah, cliffhanger. What do you mean there's more? Okay, now I really don't understand the episode structure of this series.
Yeah, I did. I totally bought the moment, though, between Thorin and Bilbo. Like, I feel like...
Yeah.
I mean, this, we've already said the stakes of this film are so low, but for them to have that, Thorin be the proud dwarf who just wants to get his home back, who wants to be king and wants to lead, and him just being like, what the hell is this hobbit doing? He's cramping my style. Go away. You're going to endanger us. And then that moment where he goes, he basically says, I was mistaken. You're great. Yay. And hugs.
Yeah.
I loved it. I did.
I will say, I love the moment between those two, and that does work. But there is that recurring question that gets put to Gandalf throughout the film, why the halfling? And I got to the end of the film and was like, you know what? I don't think the halfling was a great call either.
That was the tragedy. Because, again, in the book, you do get a little bit of, hobbits are really good at doing this, and it's done in that childish sort of storytelling. It's the hobbits, it turns out, are very good at being quiet and are able to, they also like second breakfasts. And we didn't get any of that. We just got, he's a hobbit, of course he's a hobbit. Didn't you see The Lord of the Rings?
That's true. I think a bit too much assumed knowledge. I will say I got a text message from my brother going, how the fuck did Bilbo get away from the goblins just by ducking? He was just like, what the fuck just happened? And I do think that it's potentially a failure of the story that, I mean, Gandalf does say where at the very beginning they can be unseen and unsmelled and unsensed and if they want to be. But it was demonstrated with Bilbo just going, duck, and getting out of the way. And my brother obviously was like, how the hell did that happen?
To be perfectly honest, by that point, I had to sit there and go, what? Oh, no, I think I once read the book and I think I can remember that they've got that skill. It was
Martin
Freeman
done.
Was excellent, but The Hobbit was really just not played out at all.
Yeah, as much as we hated the opening act, I did really like his character and being like the frumpy homebody, didn't want to go on adventure and like, what are you doing? You're eating all my food. And then I don't have a handkerchief. I need to go back. Like, he did establish himself there. And Martin Freeman was
perfect. But we learned nothing about hobbits.
But we know nothing. We didn't even realize.
It only takes two scenes to really sell that.
Oh my God. Yeah. No, it needs two scenes.
And as we all know, it's slightly kiddie. So I think we would have been forgiving if they'd done it in a kind of kiddie fashion.
Yeah. Right. Well, let's finish off with the cliffhanger. And to me, Martin Freeman did totally land the line, yes, I think the worst is behind us now.
Yeah,
like, yes.
And you end on a laugh.
But that was
the film, let's hope he's right.
And the thing is, that was also the moment where you do know they cast him by just watching him as Tim in The Office.
Totally. Like,
that was just such a Tim moment. It was perfect.
Totally. He does capture some of the I'm smarter than I look-ness of his character from Sherlock.
Indeed.
That's a little bit of a compilation.
And we're about to... I want Sherlock and Dr. Watson to show down. Like, how cool is that? Do they, like, have a contractual obligation to be in each other's productions now?
No, it just turns out there are at least two people who can spot good actors.
Ah, there you go. All right. Well, thanks, guys. We've got two more of these to review, but I guess we'll call this one for the nays.
I'm going to call unexpected.
Unexpectedly bad or unexpectedly disappointing.
Unexpectedly
Mark.
Disappointing.
He needs a hug. All right. And to our listeners, thanks for downloading this podcast. We'll be sure to bring you more from the Spoiler Guys soon.